In the deep recesses of time there was the CLI. Yea, and we doth type ye commands into the screen and conjured dark arts. We summoned magic and we were wizards, ruling a land of our own enchantment, packets going where we willed in just the way our cast spells said they would. But as we wizards age, we find that we're a little too slow in our spell-casting abilities. Software is upstaging us as the new magician in the village. The masterful software wizard cares not for the CLI with which we conjured. Nay, software demands models and APIs upon which to work its will. And so it is on today's Packet Pusher Show. We are visited by the sponsoring wizards of Cisco, here to discuss device programmability, network modeling with Yang, and iOS XR service level API. Our robed and pointy-headed friends are Santiago Alvarez, distinguished engineer, and Retta Haddad, principal engineer, both at Cisco. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. And Santiago, I'm going to open up the show asking you this. Would you give us an idea of the problems that service providers are trying to solve when it comes to configuring the network? We talk a lot about network automation on the Packet Pushers, and each group kind of has their own unique challenges. So give us that some background on service providers specifically.
Yes. Typically, what we see with customers is the drive for speed and scale. And I know that that sounds like a cliche, right? Like we always talk about the network continues to grow, the bandwidth continues to grow. So what is really different this time? And the way I personally see it is to some extent that the catalyst was the cloud. In compute, the problems of scalability were just multiple orders of magnitude more complex than what we have faced in networking. And I personally see it as kind of that, those lessons that were learned for compute in the cloud are kind of bleeding now into networking, and you know, keeping pace with the amount of growth is just not economically feasible anymore unless you heavily rely on automation. We've also seen for quite a few customers that it's not just speed and scale, but it's actually innovation and differentiation. So actually, programmability becomes not just a way to do things faster and a larger scale, but do things differently from their competitors. So it's also like those three are the main drivers.
Now, you mentioned automation in there, and I'm going to interpret that as to meaning programmability. Maybe that's too fine a point, but let me ask the question this way. From a standpoint of programming the network, actually being able to program the network, where are service providers really at compared to, say, hyperscale providers like Google and the Facebooks of the world that really, you know, get all excited about how they program the network?
That's an excellent question. I've been working in the service provider segment for a long time, and we always struggle to release or to introduce functionality that made routers do anything automatic. We always face customers that would come back to us and say, I don't want the device to do anything automatic. I want to have a person, an operator, to verify things, click a button, make sure that nothing bad is going to happen, right? So there's a big gap. I think it's a combination of skill sets. It's a combination of cultures. But on the positive side, I would say that there's the common realization of traditional service providers that going forward is not going to be business as usual, that they really need to start that transformation. And I think they've come out in public acknowledging that, and I see them actually taking very active steps to make that transition.
Yeah, it's interesting that we're making the transition now, more or less, as you put it, because we have to. We need to get to a point where the network is programmable and that we can trust software to do some of what we would formerly insist that a human operator would do before. And I know where that mindset comes from, because a lot of what was available 10, well, even 5 years ago, trust it to program my network for me? No, I'm not taking any chances there. I'm going to have, you know, an engineer look at this thing and review it and then make it go. So, we've moved past that. We're at that point now where to keep up with the rest of infrastructure provisioning and to provide certain services that we might like to provide to our customers with our network, then software's got to come to bear and do some of the work for the humans. So, all right, so now let's get into some nuts and bolts, Santiago. We've got programmability and automation as a tool. Programmability is going to let us use software to manage the network, and That's nice as a concept, but a challenge that we've noticed here on Packet Pushers is there's really no standard interface to manage the network. Every vendor is kind of different, but yet the IETF and the Open Config Router, they're all pushing Yang and Yang models for the network, and I'm kind of hearing Cisco's getting behind this and is broadly supporting Yang. Can you talk about that a bit?
The traditional challenge, there have been multiple challenges historically with trying to, at least from a manageability perspective, automate routing device or a network device in general. There were a set of technologies that they really didn't integrate too well, and they have multiple deficiencies. Historically, we've relied on what? We relied on CLI, we relied on SNMP, and we relied on syslog. All those three components have deficiencies. They're either not structured enough or they're not efficient enough. So kind of the paradigm that we're moving towards now is to have a common set of data models that really act as the base infrastructure on which you build all this manageability toolkit. And those different toolkits or those different protocols that you use are completely decoupled with the data model. So it's really a more flexible way to approach manageability because you have your data models as a base infrastructure if you want. And that's decoupled from whatever encoding you use to exchange data, whatever protocol that you use to manage your device or whatever transport you choose to use. So it's really a complete redesign, I would say, of the approach to manage the device.
Yeah, but Yang is just a model, though, and I've talked to some folks who have made the point that Yang, in theory, if it all goes according to plan, a network engineer maybe doesn't even have to care about Yang. It might be used more by developers as a reference for their APIs and so on, but not something an engineer has to care about. So maybe give us some context around that. Does an engineer have to care about Yang, or do you think it's going to kind of fall off to the side is a nice thing to be aware of, but nothing that you have to worry about?
That's a very interesting question. We make a very, very conscious effort to keep network engineers and developers away from the details of Yang. I think Yang language itself should be very important to that person designing the model, but it should be almost irrelevant for the person using the model. Okay, the person using the model, whether it's a seasoned developer, whether it's a network engineer that is trying to do some automation, the focus should be on the structure, the data structure, the hierarchy, the data that the model defines, the layout that it has. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Yang or the syntax of Yang actually should be completely relevant, and as hopefully we'll be able to discuss later today, I'll give you examples of some of the things that we do to completely hide away those details from network operators, network engineers, and developers.
So what you're saying there, I think, is in the same way that for SNMP MIBs, most people don't actually know what a MIB is or how it works or what the data format is. They just see charts coming up on the screen. In the management platforms, Yang models has a similar sort of thing in that if you're the person writing a charting tool or a software app on top of it, you might need to know about Yang, but only if you need to know about what data can be extracted. Otherwise, you can probably use the data without actually knowing how it got there.
Yeah, that's correct. I would say, just to give you maybe a concrete example, let's say if for some reason you're trying to do some automation that is specific to, let's say, the interfaces of a device, right? You may need, of course, you need to understand that, hey, the model defines a list of interfaces. Interfaces have a name. And these are the attributes that I can configure, for instance, on an interface. I can put a description, and description is a string. I can have an MTU. I can have multiple IP addresses. So that hierarchy, that structure, what data is available to me, what are considered to be valid values for that data, whether it's configuration data that I'm reading or operational data that I'm consuming, that I need to know. Mm. But I shouldn't need to know the details of how Yang is defining all that. I don't need to understand Yang containers. I don't need to understand what is a lift list. I don't need to understand. And I'm just throwing all the jargon that is using Yang. I don't need to understand what a grouping is, what a sub module. Those are details that only the person developing or creating you know, designing a model, you need to know. If we expose all those details, or if you have to expose all those details, we're really going to create a very difficult barrier of entry. So, so, and I think fortunately we have a lot of tools to kind of hide all those details.
Interesting. Okay, now SNMP has come up in the conversation, and those of us that have worked with an SNMP for a number of years know that, yeah, you've got MIB2, and you've got a few elements of the global MIB tree that are shared commonly among devices, but all the interesting bits are hidden way down in special magical MIBs that that the vendors have uniquely created for each of their devices. What is Cisco's take on standard Yang models versus kind of mirroring what we ended up with in SNMP, where there is a bunch of private MIBs that are unique to vendor devices?
I think, to be very candid with you, I think models are not different when it comes to the opposing forces that you have in technology between generalization and specialization. And I think those forces are always going to exist there in technology. And I think at the end of the day, you have to be very pragmatic that these technologies, standards, and vendor-specific technologies don't exist in a vacuum. They exist because they're trying to solve business problems. And when you have a business problem, you solve it with the tool that you have available and the one that solves it the best. So we are heavily embracing open, what we consider open models, implementing ITF, implementing OpenConfig. We actually, I feel very confident saying that we're leading the implementation of OpenConfig in particular. But those models are not going to be the answer to all customers, to all deployments, and to all business problems. So we're also offering our native models that provide all the exposure to all the capabilities of the device.
So this sounds like SNMP again, where there was SNMP MIBs which were standardized, but not everybody could agree on an SNMP MIB for every situation. So vendors then decided to create their own MIBs to expose features that seemed relevant to them and the messaging that they wanted to give to customers. Now, that was good and bad. It was good in the sense that data models could be extended, information could be presented without, you know, going through a standardization process. But on the other hand, it made it difficult to do multi-vendor management and operations. Is that Yang's going to suffer from those same issues, I think, more generally?
Yeah, I wouldn't say, for instance, that the benefit of Yang is that it's going to solve the problem of standardization of the interface across vendors. I think the benefits come from the fact that it's a common data definition, independent of, again, of the protocol, the tool chains, and the workflows that the customer wants to use. And that is a way more modern way to leverage software tools and leverage automation. I think that's really where the benefits come from. You have way better ways to automatically build toolkits, more faster toolkits that are faster and scale way better. Okay, it's not necessarily from the fact that you're going to have this magical data model that completely abstracts 100% of all vendors' capability. Because you, when you really think about it, the only way to achieve that nirvana, whether it is Yang or MIPS or whatever, is create this humongous data structure that is the superset of everybody.
So Santiago, talk us through what the native Yang models are for iOS XR specifically. What have you got?
Yeah, so we actually made a let me first say that XR has had internal schemas for the longest time. That's actually, we're glad that we did that investment many years ago, but those schemas were kind of hidden from customers. They existed as internal structures. So what we've done in the last 2-3 years is actually start exposing all that information to customers as Yang data models. And actually, you have a dramatically larger amount of information, both configuration, but especially in operational state. There's a dramatic amount of information that is available now on the devices through Yang models. And as maybe some of you guys know, the nice thing with Yang is that the box is going to advertise in its capabilities. These are the models that I support, that you can programmatically read those data models so you don't have to go to a web page and kind of figure out what are the data models. That information you can retrieve, and actually you can build your automation in a way that connects to the device, reads all the models, and automatically integrates that into your automation framework.
Okay, so you had kind of a, you know, a lucky design choice that you made a long time ago with the internal schemas that allowed you to map those internal schemas to, you know, expose them, if you will, as a Yang model. Does that mean there's feature parity in the Yang models with all of XR capabilities, or is it more like there's an iOS XR release, and then maybe in a future iOS XR release, you'll get the Yang model that supports that new feature?
Let me say first that one extra check that we're doing very carefully is that every new functionality that we introduce, we really, really make sure that there's no breakage in terms of supporting the data model. So there, we shouldn't have any new functionality going out that escapes without data model support. Okay. We did a lot of work in the last 2 or 3 years to really go back and make sure that we covered, that we were covering every functionality with schemas. The way we treat data model coverage right now is that basically if you as a customer find something that is not covered by a model, it's treated as a defect, as a software defect. That shouldn't be there in the first place. Someone may hold me, you know, to the word and say, hey, I can find here a counterexample. Well, there's some few corner cases, for instance, and we can find with counterexamples, for instance, commands that exist on CLI that are interactive in nature that are supposed to be used by a human. So there's you can find a handful of commands, exec commands, for instance, that for which there's not a model. But other than that, I'm very confident saying, you know, we have coverage. And if you find in a particular area that doesn't have coverage, it's reported as a defect and we'll work on closing the gap.
Well, yeah, you summed it up right in the beginning there. You made the point that, right, if there's a new feature that's going out the door, it's got a schema, you know, and a model that goes along with it. That's the intent, so that everything, that's all released in tandem. If I've got the new feature and on this new release of iOS XR, I've got the model for it as well. But modeling and the models that we're getting, that's not a programmatic interface, right? So the iOS XR Yang models, how does that relate to an API or something that I can program?
The models are, as I said, they just define, you know, configuration, like a configuration hierarchy, or they define the structure of operational data, and they also can define commands that I can run on the device. Leveraging those models, you can interface with different protocols. In our case, you can use NetConf. You can use also gRPC. And on top of those protocols, which kind of define both NetConf and gRPC, defines the RPCs, the calls that you can make to the device to change configuration, retrieve operational data. On top of those protocols, we are actually building an SDK, a set of APIs that kind of abstract. They give you language bindings to very easily interact with that infrastructure.
Okay, you just mentioned several different APIs and methods that you can use to interface iOS XR. So are they all maintained in tandem so that there's feature parity no matter which method or API I choose?
Yes, that's a very interesting attribute. I mentioned before that in the new manageability framework, the data models are decoupled from the choice of transport protocol and encoding that you use.
Right.
So if we implement a model, that model works automatically on whatever. If you choose to use NetConf, you can use the data model. If you choose to use gRPC, you can use the model. If tomorrow we add support for RESTConf, it would just automatically the data model work because those in the infrastructure, those are actually decoupled components.
I love the term automatically. It's just, I mean, it's great when you put a system in place that where you get to use that and it's legitimate. So it's interesting that you hear that, because that means if a customer comes to you and says, yeah, we really want, as you said, RESTConf, you can say, okay, you can prioritize that and choose to add that. And there's not so much backend integration work that you have to do to make that happen. So.
And another thing that we did also, the decoupling with encoding, right? Like some people are okay with XML, some people are not okay with XML, they want JSON. There's nothing in the how we build and implement our data models that would impose a particular type of encoding. Yes, sometimes you have limitations on, for instance, if you choose the NetConf, well, you got to use XML because that's the language of NetConf, right? But if you use gRPC, you can use JSON. Or it's independent. The infrastructure is independent of the encoding. So if there is any restriction in the implementation, it's a restriction that is created motivated, I'd say, by the choice of protocol and the specifications of the protocol, but it's not an intrinsic implementation of or restriction of our implementation.
All right, we've been talking about the models, we've been talking about APIs, but there is a certain contingent of people listening to this that are going, an API is not a tool. An API doesn't do anything for me by itself. And maybe they're a little bit daunted by the idea of having to write their own tool, their own scripts or their own software to do what they need to leverage that API. You know, what is Cisco's message to those folks that are maybe not upset, but are a little like, oh man, I got to write my own code to leverage this API?
We have customers, different skill sets, and customers definitely that fit in the camp that you're describing. For a lot of customers, they are comfortable with, hey, either I have software skills or I'm trying to develop the software skills in my organization, and I can figure out how to do my own orchestration, for instance, if you want. For some other customers, they say, hey, I want more of a platform that already solves this for me. So I would say for those customers that don't want to deal too much with the specifics of interacting directly with the device, for instance, our NSO product based on the TLF technologies is a great solution for them. It already provides a much higher level of abstraction in which you really programming the network, you're not programming devices. So that's kind of what I would say. If you either want to do your own device programmability and consume the APIs of the device, or maybe you want to take a simpler view and just deal with the abstracted network. And I think that's where the NSO product fits pretty well.
I think there's a key transition there, which you just highlighted, was once you get a modeling language, you don't need to start thinking about your network as hop, 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 device, 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 function for and each, you know, like interface in, interface out. You can just start to think about it as an end-to-end flow, because these modeling languages make it so easy to see into the devices. So
exactly.
Normally, the way that we configure devices is we do it with permanent state. That is, you configure something, and then it's done. So you create static modeling or static configurations, and then the device is done, and then you walk away and you cross your fingers and hope that the ephemeral state inside the device does what you think it does. And what I mean by ephemeral state is, you know, how many TCAM entries are being used, how much interface bandwidth is being used, how much, how deep are the buffers in the hierarchical quash that you just configured, or, you know, how much memory is left. All these sorts of things are ephemeral state, and they're temporal, or that is, they change over time. And one of the more interesting things about models is it also gives you a way to start talking about capturing ephemeral state. And that leads into streaming telemetry. Is that right? So you start to say,
yes,
I've got a model. I need to see, oh, hang on, this interface is now running at 80%. I should be streaming that information to you. Or my cost buffers have suddenly been overrun in a particular class. I should stream that telemetry information away to you. Or my NetFlow data is an example of streaming data. It's not streaming telemetry. It's actually a data format, or more correctly, a model. I see NetFlow as a model. But it's this ability to transition from device-to-device, static state or permanent state to I now need to see the network as a living, changeable, fungible, at any point in time, the data flows change the way the network operates, and you need to have this constant data coming off the devices to feed into a system that sits above the models. Is that, is my vision there correct?
No,
and is there any gaps in that logic?
Yeah. I'm so happy you actually brought it up, because so far we kind of been talking about data models, and we say, hey, yeah, you can be, and I was talking, hey, you got configuration data models, you got operational data models, and you can kind of interact with the device. You can maybe make configuration changes to the device or read from the device what the operational state is. But another important component of the whole manageability solution is the telemetry piece. So it's actually leveraging exactly the same data model infrastructure to push the data, the operational data, directly from the device, okay? And the whole idea is that I should be able, very efficiently, I want to be able to create a closed loop in which programmatically I'm able to configure the device, and the device reports back to me the state in near real time. We're able to, I don't need to, pour salt and vinegar on that wound. But we all know how fast you can get interface counters, for instance, on SNMP, yeah. or how difficult or how often can you really retrieve that information in SNMP. With telemetry, you can completely flip the paradigm, have the device stream that data to you. Is data is defined in the same format, is the structure of the data model. You're already familiar with that. The data models, you can, again, put them through tool chains to make the benefits and be able to consume that data. And you, it's very significantly easier for you to create these closed loops in which you're monitoring real time and you're detecting anomalies in the network and reacting, not only introducing changes proactively to the network configuration changes because you got a new service or something like that, but also doing anomaly detection and reacting to events in the network. Mm-hmm. And it's all within the same manageability framework built on top of the data models.
So let's just break this down for somebody. Let's go back to beginner level a little bit, just for a second or two. When you say streaming telemetry, are you saying like my interface, I'm sending you the utilization of the interface on a second-by-second basis? Is that something I could do with a model?
You could do it. Actually, let me put a plug here. Yep. 2 days ago, I did a presentation at NANOG 71. It's in the YouTube, the video. You guys can go and watch it. Mm-hmm. And actually, I built a very simple app, very simple, just a demo of provision appearing between two devices. And I do it with a kind of a closed loop configuration, which I read my configuration locally. I enable the interface. I wait for the device to report back that the interface came up. At that point, I do my BGP configuration. I wait for the device to report back that proactively via telemetry. And then I do all my provisioning of that peering. Yes, it's a demo setup. It's not a completely realistic example, but I can very easily show all that provisioning loop with validation happening easily in 15 seconds, 30 seconds.
So just for people listening at home, a closed loop or a feedback loop, what Santiago is alluding to there is you do something and then you validate that something's happened, right?
Exactly. So,
and that's what you mean by a closed loop. I didn't just configure something and then cross my fingers. I configured something, and then the machine that I configured comes back with some information to say what you configured just worked. That's different from verification. Verification is when you configure something, and then some other way goes in and confirms that what you configured is validated. That's not a sound measurement technology, or at a fundamental engineering science level, what you always want to create is a feedback loop. I configure this. Can I measure the results of that configuration in using an out of band or not the same way that I made the configuration to validate that the configuration actually happened? And that's not something we've usually or pretty much ever been able to do at the command line or with legacy APIs like SNMP or Syslog.
It was just too expensive, too slow.
Yes.
And also SNMP wasn't a great API. It's not there's value to the way the Yang model is created in the sense that it's a well-defined, well-structured, extensible. And if you don't understand that, then get a textbook because now we're really, really into the weeds about what Yang is. These are just things that, in the old days, what we used to do was make a configuration and then maybe you get a syslog message to confirm that what you configured was it. This is a completely different way of operating devices. It really is a functional, it's a step change and actually moving into I'd like to think of it as actually computer science. It's a thing,
Yes.
Well, we should move the conversation along and get into some more iOS XR specifics. You guys have released the iOS XR service level API. And Reda, I think this is your area here that you were going to talk about, that service level API for iOS XR. What's unique about this specific API? What drove the creation of it? Give us some background.
Yeah, sure. Mainly the service layer API was basically an augmentation to what we have today in terms of what Santiago has been talking about for manageability. But it is mainly targeting the control plane and not the what is traditionally known as the northbound interface and so on. So from a control plane perspective, if we think about what customers are trying to achieve through a network, right? They want to manage the network, they want to operate the network, and in some cases they want to fine-tune the network based on some routing policy or some information they have specific to their network. So today, what are the tools that they have to fine-tune their control plane policies, given that traditionally this was the territory for control plane protocols like BGP? So they do have configuration for BGP. They do have configuration for a matrix of protocols, but there is no programmatic way to augment BGP or any routing protocol to be more efficient in the network or have routing policies installed for their specific needs.
Let's just qualify that for a second, Retta. So you're saying, in other words, BGP, as built, can't do something for me that I need it to do, and so I need some other tool to augment what BGP's capabilities are because I have some unique requirement.
Correct. Okay. That's exactly what we're saying here. So BGP is fundamentally running the internet today, but as seen by hyperscale vendors, there are some corner cases that BGP does not address. And what we're trying to do is basically figure out ways to help these service providers address these corner cases, and we can talk about these. But programmatically, how these service providers can do that today is maybe they do have two APIs, right? One is the manageability API that Santiago was talking about. And the second is maybe very low in the stack, which is the forwarding, or traditionally called the hardware abstraction API, that is tailored towards controllers. But there is nothing in between that allows controllers to be integrated with traditional routing protocols to basically selectively configure routing policies.
Okay, so again, we're the service level API. Then we're below traditional control plane protocols. You gave the example of BGP, but we're above an API that would just jam things right into the FIB directly, like maybe an OpenFlow would.
That's correct. So basically, some customers don't want to manage the low level details of a platform, right? They just want to take a working network and then selectively change some routing path in that network. They don't want to remove the routing protocols. They just want to augment, based on their needs, some of these routing protocols. Okay. So the service layer API is tailoring exactly that use case. So basically, how do I fine-tune my network based on things that traditional network protocols do not allow me to do or are not there in the knobs of these routing protocols.
Okay, this reminds me a bit of the IETF effort I2RS. Is that a fair comparison?
Yeah, I think it is a fair comparison. I2RS was trying to achieve a control plane API to basically get into the RIB directly. So what we have done is we listen to our customers and try to tailor that API towards exactly their use cases. So that is kind of relates to that, yes.
Okay, so now that I got an understanding of what this is it analogous to an API anywhere else in Cisco's world, or is this pretty unique to the iOS XR platform?
Right now, it is unique to the XR platform. I think this is mainly driven by business case or use cases where XR is deployed, but nothing prevents this API to go beyond XR at this point of time. It's just basically driven by a business case.
So a couple of things here, a couple of background things. One is documentation. If I am a customer and I wish to consume the service level API, is there documentation that I can follow, or is that like a special thing I got to request from Cisco and they deliver it to me if I sign off on the right paperwork?
Yeah, so the approach we've taken here is to be open about the API. So the entire API is on GitHub. Specifically, it's in xrdocs.github.io. And for documentation, we did integrate Doxygen attributes in the API. The API is gRPC-based, by the way. So all of the gRPC protobuf files are actually annotated And we render the documentation straight from the exact APIs. We have also introduced, as part of that GitHub repository, tutorials and test cases that basically can be literally copy-pasted into somebody's you know, quick start kind of a tutorial. Mm-hmm. Should be very easy to follow, very well documented, and we eat our own dog food. So one of our solutions is using the SL API, so it is well tailored towards developers.
No, you don't eat your own dog food. I've heard it that you drink your own champagne.
Oh, and that's even better.
Okay,
I don't know about I don't know about you, but champagne is my kind of way of doing it.
So the service level API seems kind of really specific and targeted sort of use cases. So make me care about this. What are the use cases where I'm going to leverage service level API for iOS XR?
So there are several use cases here. I'll talk about a couple. So one of our customers came in and said, okay, I do have a proprietary IGP implementation that basically is solving a problem that I don't want to share with my competitors. Is there a way to run my IGP on your XR? And we said, okay, so the service layer API is actually tailored to allow a proprietary extension of an IGP to run exactly on XR or right next to the XR protocols.
So in that scenario, would the proprietary IGP be running off box, like on an x86 somewhere, and then leveraging the service level API for the forwarding entries?
So the service layer API is gRPC-based. Obviously, the term RPC is remote procedure call. So you can run external to the box, but we do allow you to run on the box as well. Nothing prevents that protocol to run on the box as well, as an agent to a controller or as a proprietary protocol implementation. I'd like to bring another use case that we demoed recently on in Nanog this week. Where a customer basically said, hey, I have capacity constraints, coupled with volatile traffic and performance limitations. BGP is great, but I cannot configure it the way I want it to be. And if I want to bring protocol extensions, I have to go through a lengthy, long journey of, getting it into standards, getting it implemented, getting various vendors to interop and certify these things. It's going to take me a long, long journey. And in Nanog, we have basically showcased how this, edge fabric problem can be solved literally over a hackathon within a couple of hours through the service layer API in a programmatic approach.
Okay, so you demoed that at Nanog, hackathon style, and what was the uptake? What were the feedback, the comments that you got from folks? If you did a hackathon, that means there were a whole bunch of people you were feeding them pizza and orange soda very late.
So I think the feedback was great. We actually, in the hackathon, we won the first runner-up, I believe. I wasn't there, but some of my colleagues were doing the actual hackathon. And they did win the first runner-up for that category. So I think it was well-received.
And is this available on any iOS XR platform? In other words, I could see how this could be hardware-specific under the hood, possibly?
No, not at all. Basically, in XR, the platform-specific layer is below the RIB.
Yep.
And since this API is above the RIB, mm-hmm. And by the way, it covers a label manager, MPLS, and so on, it is considered platform independent. So we do have it starting, release 6.1 or 6.2 on almost all of our new platforms moving forward.
Hmm. Now, I know i2RS is not exactly screaming through the IATF here. Last I heard, it was kind of mired in a number of different issues. But if i2RS actually became a standard and customers wanted to leverage it, would there be a mechanism to have that become part of the service level API?
So we have built the service layer API using gRPC services, and we did have in mind that at some point in time, this API would need to be a standard API across vendors. And gRPC basically allows different services to be published. So exactly how we have vendor-specific native models or XR models that are a superset of the standard Yang models, we will probably have a standard service layer API with, you know, extensive features that XR gives gives to service providers, enabled through a superset of the service layer API that is not standardized. So we hope that the entire API becomes standard. We can work with the standard bodies at some point in time to figure out how to do that.
Reda, thanks for the details on service level API, and that's. It's, there's a lot going on there if I wanted to get into that. Now, Reddy, you had mentioned some resources, xrdocs.github.io. And Santiago, what about you? Are there additional resources that people that are trying to get into this world with modeling, leveraging service-level API, perhaps, that that they should be looking for as well?
Oh, we have a lot of resources available. We have the SDK with bindings in Python, C++. We got the documentation. We got all the packages available on GitHub, and also the Python package index. We got blogs. We got documentation, as I mentioned before. We got a community. The easiest way to find all those resources is just one domain. All you need to do is ydk.io. YDK is the Yang Development Kit, is the SDK that we make available. And if you go to ydk.io, that's your single stop for all the resources.
Ah, excellent. And then, of course, Cisco, you guys, as Cisco, the company, have blogs. There's the blogs.cisco.com/getyourbuildon. There's blogs.cisco.com/SP for more information there. And there's, of course, Twitter accounts, Cisco SP 360, and so on. And so, again, HTTP... ydk.io for jumping off for a lot of this. And then we'll have these links at packetpushers.net as well for the blog post that accompanies this show. Now, are you guys social, where if people wanted to get in touch with either of you directly, you have a Twitter handle or something where people could tweet at you or otherwise get in touch? Reda, starting with you?
I don't have a Twitter, actually. But
good for you, my friend. Good for you.
call me old-fashioned. But people can get hold of me through my email, I guess, rehadd@cisco.com.
And what about you, Santiago?
I do have one. It has a little bit of an obscure name. It's number one Pontes. So that's 111 Pontes. And believe me, there's a logic behind the madness, and it's actually quite related to networking. So whoever out there is able to figure out what 111 Pontes means, you get a beer from me. Okay, hopefully not too many. Too many people are able to get it. So that's my handle and my user ID. My handle on Twitter, and it's actually my user ID also on GitHub. If you want to follow me, good news. I don't tweet about where I am, my dog, my cat, or
what you had for breakfast.
Exactly. I post technical stuff with certain frequency if I think it's going to be useful for people. So you definitely see one or two tweets every week with tips, with new articles, with releases. I try to make it as useful as I would like it to be for me. So do follow me.
Well, thanks to both of you for coming on the show today. And our thanks to Cisco for sponsoring the Packet Pushers. Conversations like this, really, it helps grow the networking community, which is what we're all about here. We are very glad to have the vendors take part and expand the discussion. It allows us to do what we do. So you can find this and many more of what we believe are truly excellent technical podcasts, white papers, newsletters, analytical articles, and our community blog posts. All of that's at packetpushers.net. And we're all over social media. Just do a search for Packet Pushers and see where we turn up. Last but not least, remember that too much technology would never be enough.